You're on ABC Radio National. Time for The Science Show, in which we catch up and find out what happened next. I'm Robin Williams. And no, they're not singing Wobbly Wobbly Wobbly, as some listeners thought, but 1, 2, 3, 4, the chorus from Einstein on the Beach, the opera by Philip Glass. And we do have 1, 2, 3, 4 pieces of catch-up, beginning with Rowan Webb. You may remember Rowan from the University of New England, Armidale, dying of cancer, yet wanting to leave his skeleton to science intact, something that seemed impossible in July.
I'm asking for the skeletal elements to be preserved intact so that they are available for physical anthropological research. I came across a PhD student when I started at UNE who was working on postcranial analysis, and she had checked out all the collections in Australia and found they had plenty of Aboriginal skeletons but almost nothing in the way of non-Aboriginal collections.
Well, this is rather surprising because we assume that if you see something in a medical school hanging up, you know, the students playing with it, that it came from a straightforward European ancestry human being.
Most of the skellies that people identify with doctors' rooms and teaching, most of those probably would have come from India up until the 1980s. And I can remember students, when I was one, having trouble working out where the muscle insertions were because they were poor, understaffed Indians who just didn't get enough tucker.
Well, what about those bodies that are used by medical students? Surely once the organs have been used, you can keep the skeleton. What's against that?
One of the things that happens with students is that they're not necessarily as skilled with a scalpel. And sometimes what they're designing their dissection to do is to illustrate something that requires a certain amount of carving up the skelly as well. Like if you want to get inside the cranium, and that requires a saw.
So why does it mean so much to you to want to leave your skeleton to science?
Because I can actually provide not just the skeleton, but all of what archaeologists would call the ethnography that goes with it. Like, if you look at the shin bones, especially the one on my right leg, I've got a whole stack of rugosities up and down it, which...
Come again?
Rugosity, roughnesses, you know, it's all horrible. And people would have looked at that a century ago and said that I had had secondary syphilis. Whereas I know that as a member of the InterVarsity Judo team at Melbourne, I was a bit of a hard practicer, and it was continual hacking at my attempts to do a particular throw and the other person blocking it that I would get their ankle bone belting up my shin bone and producing all these subperiosteal hematomas.
Rowan Webb with his dodgy legs. Well, he died 2 weeks ago, and yes, he got his wish. And the anthropologists will be able to use his skelly, as he called it, in the interests of science. Someone else who died really before his time in July was Professor Steve Schneider. He was on The Science Show many times, and before he left Australia, he recorded this programme with SBS Television, which you can see next Tuesday, Insight with Jenny Brockie.
Hi, and thanks for joining us. Man-made climate change was once a major public concern, but political momentum to address it has waned, and the public has become more sceptical. Tonight, an audience of doubters meet one of the world's leading climatologists who'll try to win them over. Professor Stephen Schneider is from Stanford University and is a lead author with the IPCC. Stephen Schneider, thanks very much for joining us here, and thank you to our audience too for joining us here at the University of New South Wales. Good to have you all. Now, I want to give you a flavour, Stephen Schneider, of what you're up against. So I'm going to go to our audience first. Tanya, do you believe in man-made climate change?
Man-made? Not at all.
Why?
No one has proven to me that it's man-made at all. All I see is a big hysteria. Just for money. The only reason you're getting grant money is because climate change, the planet is warming. It's the only reason you're getting grant money. If we didn't have this hysteria, there would be no grants, there would be no money, no people money making money at all.
Peter Locke, what about you?
No, I don't believe in it at all. I believe in climate change. The climate always changes. But I haven't seen any evidence to date that discounts natural climate change, and I've seen nothing in any of the literature that I've read that indicates that anything is abnormal, A, with the warming or the rate of warming.
All right, Stephen Schneider, plenty for you to deal with there. You've been looking into these issues for 40 years. What's the most compelling argument that you can throw back at these people, and they're all doubters, to make the case for man-made climate change?
I heard the word, I don't believe. Science is not about belief. Science is about evidence. And therefore, your beliefs have to be built upon looking at the whole wide range of evidence. And it is completely legitimate, as everybody said, to look over a long period of history. In fact, looking back at the geologic past, that's the backdrop against which we calibrate our understanding.
Steve Schneider, fielding questions from doubters to the very end. He died a few days later. But the programme in which he answered those critics will be shown on Tuesday, SBS television at 7:30 p.m. Insight. In June, a timely broadcast, Sharon Carleton presented a special science show about Christmas Island, well known for refugees, but more so in some quarters for wildlife. This is what happened next. Sharon.
In June, we looked at the struggling biodiversity on Christmas Island, its crabs and yellow crazy ants, the decreasing number of Abbott's booby birds, and the tiny pipistrelle bat, which is probably extinct. There's a battle between phosphate mining and the environment. Professor Bob Beaton headed the expert working group set up by Environment Minister Peter Garrett to report on the island.
In ecology, people talk about keystone species, and you know, they're species that organise an ecosystem. Those things are maddeningly hard to demonstrate in most ecosystems, but you go to Christmas Island and here it is, right in your face. So as an ecologist, that is just mind-bending. A species of crab running the system, and then that species of crab under threat, and you can walk 20 metres, crab, no crab, you can just see the difference. That, in ecological terms, is remarkable.
For much of this year, Minister Garrett has had before him a proposal from the Christmas Island Phosphate Company for 8 new mining leases, which would have meant clearing another 250 hectares. In early July, just before the election was announced, the minister rejected the proposal because, as he said, the likely economic and social benefits of expanding the mining simply do not outweigh the significant impact of these activities on the environment, threatened species and their habitat. The Christmas Island Shire President, Gordon Thompson, told me that as far as protecting the environment was concerned, mission accomplished. Now, he said, it's up to the new government to make sure resources are found to assist Christmas Island's transition from a mining economy to one founded on tourism, education and scientific research.
Sharon Carleton, and our fourth catch-up is with the Eureka Prizes, at least the one given by Voiceless for the protection of animals through scientific research. We noted briefly at the time of the work done by Professor Chris Evans, recognised around the world. Here's more from Daniel Keogh.
Now imagine that you're a scientist who's keen on studying complex communication in animals. You're looking for a species that can identify each other, that lives in large social groups and can signal to each other when food or danger is about. In fact, you're after a species that is intelligent enough to have evolved deceptive behaviours to trick others with these signals. Now, what is this incredibly intelligent species that you might be studying? Well, it's not a primate. In fact, it's not even a mammal. What I've just described is the behaviour of chooks, chickens. Gallus gallus, the domesticated animal that most people only think to be sophisticated in culinary terms. Not many people know just how developed their behaviour really is. Professor Chris Evans has been studying the behaviour of chickens for more than 20 years. He's the director of the Centre for Integrative Study of Animal Behaviour at Macquarie University in Sydney. Just last month, his work on the species was recognised with a special Eureka Prize during National Science Week.
The winner of the Voiceless Eureka Prize for scientific research that contributes to animal protection is Dr. Kaylin Smith and Professor Chris Evans.
The $10,000 prize was sponsored by Voiceless, the animal protection group. But as Professor Evans and his team have discovered, chickens aren't exactly voiceless, at least not in the literal sense. The work of Professor Evans has done a lot to show that chickens are much more than just egg-laying automatons. They have very complex means of communication. They can use variations in sound, changes in posturing, and even extravagant displays to get their messages across. Professor Evans has shown that chickens can communicate precise information about the presence of food or the location of predators. Their calls can teach young chicks what food is best to eat, and they're even capable of deceptive behaviour. Chris Evans.
They can signal with remarkable precision about critical events in their world, such as the appearance of a particular type of predator or the discovery of food. And they are not always truthful. Males attempt to lure hens with deceptive food calling, but females remember each male's track record and quickly become skeptical of those that are unreliable. In nature, hens could sort the wheat from the chaff either by memorizing a male's appearance, they all have distinctive faces, or by learning his vocal idiosyncrasies. We've just shown experimentally that they do both.
The way Chris and his team at Macquarie has gone about demonstrating these findings has been rather ingenious. They've used 3D animation and video playback to simulate changes in behaviour, and have developed unique ways of recording and studying their communication in their natural environment. In fact, Chris's creativity in his research methods has recently been recognised by the international academic organisation, the Animal Behaviour Society, which has just this year awarded Professor Evans their prestigious career award, an accolade shared by some giants in biology, including E.O. Wilson, Judy Stamps, and Richard Dawkins. But Chris's year of successful wins is contrasted with his diminishing health. He was recently diagnosed with a form of motor neuron disease called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. The degenerative effect of the disease means that Chris is now confined to a wheelchair and relies on computer systems in order to communicate, much in the same way that Professor Stephen Hawking does. And while the disease isn't impeding his intellectual capability, it is making the task of communicating his research a whole lot harder. But to assist in that is some new technology that is helping people like Chris to function effectively in a digital environment. Peter Ford is the founder and CEO of Control Bionics, a company that develops assistive technology for those suffering from motor neuron disease, spinal injuries, MS, and many others. Here's Peter on meeting Professor Chris Evans.
I met him earlier this year, and he had already developed quadriplegia and had already almost completely lost the ability to speak or to verbalize. He's a world authority on animal behavior. He's just about to come on to NeuroSwitch, and he's doing academically significant work, which is a landmark for Australia and a landmark for his university, Macquarie University.
NeuroSwitch is a technology that gives control to those who are so severely disabled that other means of communication just aren't available. All that's required is for the patient to have control over one muscle in their body, and when combined with NeuroSwitch, the tiny electrical charge from that one muscle is enough to control an entire digital realm.
So in the top left-hand corner, there's a graph, and you see when I flick this finger, the graph goes up.
So it's peeking out every time you're flicking your muscles. It's
exactly.
Currently attached to your left arm.
Yes. So when I do that, you'll see the graph on the screen goes into a peak, and it goes through that red line, which is neuron switch. So it means somebody with a motor neuron disease or spinal cord injury or closed head injury or locked-in syndrome, full locked-in syndrome, it means they can now have a connection to control a switch. And once they control that switch, they can control all this other software.
So what was the experience like using this technology?
Well, let's find out. Let's wire you up.
Okay.
You've never seen it before. You've never done
exactly.
This before. There you go.
There we go. Okay, yep. Fantastic.
The top line here, the left one is a one click.
Ah.
This one is a double click, so go for the double click.
Honestly, how am I doing as
you're
a patient?
You're doing really well.
I feel like I'm failing here.
No, you're not. You're doing really well. Remember, this is your first time out of the box. You haven't had any training, and you're doing it all intuitively. Very good. Let's see if that double click's on there. Do a double click. There you go. Stop. Well done. Okay.
Bang.
Well done.
So I've done that without really moving anything other than my ring finger at the moment.
That's right.
Quite an achievement.
And here's the thing. If you were totally locked in and couldn't move anything but could get a signal to that finger, even if this arm was paralyzed, high probability is that there's enough signal coming through that muscle for you to be able to control it. And incidentally, you just hit pause.
Oh, so well, I did that cool. on purpose. Why were we speaking?
Very good.
As well.
And even if this muscle connection along here was severely depleted by a motor neuron disease or a spinal injury, you would still be able to get enough signal in there to fire it. And the NeuroSwitch software would adjust itself down to that level of that range of electricity that you're generating on that muscle, that EMG signal.
So in the space of less than 10 minutes, I was able to learn how to open programs, get the computer to talk, and, as you just heard, play some music. It was really simple to get the hang of, but it did take a lot of concentration to tense that one muscle just at the right moment. A few hours of this and I reckon I'd be mentally and physically exhausted. But these technologies give people like Chris, who have almost no other choice, the ability to communicate with others, and that impact can be profound. Soon, Chris Evans will be moving on to the NeuroSwitch system. The hope is that he'll be able to communicate his endeavours and discoveries well into the future.
Daniel Keogh, and you're listening to The Science Show on ABC Radio National, through Radio Australia and online through abc.net.au/rn. And this program, as you'll know perhaps, is very fond of birds. But we weren't aware until meeting Dr. Yossi Leshem from Tel Aviv that they could be enlisted in the cause of world peace. There are talks about Israel and Palestine in Washington right now, but no birds so far. That won't stop Dr. Leshem.
I was privileged to be one of the leaders of establishing a bird station on the land of the Knesset, of our parliament. As far as I know, we are the only parliament in the world which has a permanent bird study station on the land of the parliament.
Actually on the land of the parliament. That's amazing.
At the edge of it, it's about 1.5 acres of gardening. And the birds which are migrating from Africa back to Europe or from Europe and Asia to Africa, when they come over Jerusalem, there's a big patch of the gardens of the Knesset. So for them, it's like an oasis in the desert because Jerusalem became so big, so much building. That's for them an attraction. So we got from the government a piece of land and we succeeded to attract in the last few years 60,000 students, urban students who are coming and they see life on science, on the state. And they got, you know, these urban kids who have never seen a bird from close, when they see a bird in hand, you can see how excited they are. And then at the end of the process, when we attach a ring to the leg of the bird, we give the students to release the bird. If some of them, they don't care much. But out of a class of 40 students, you always find 4 or 5 who are getting really moved. And that's maybe the moment when we can get them at snager levels.
Does it make the politicians, the members of parliament, better behaved?
I don't believe so. You know, because with politicians are politicians. Whatever you do, it's tough with them. But some of them, yes, that's a big advantage because, first of all, this station became a meeting point for politicians, not only for migrating birds.
Yeah.
When they want to go quietly to a place and talk business, they come there.
I must tell you that every weekend I go to a place where we have, on a big deck overlooking the ocean, lots of birdseed.
Yeah.
Many, many different birds come to visit, especially if you've come across them, king parrots, which are those beautiful birds.
Yeah.
And they're very serene. And when you see birds like that, you become a very peaceful person, a very gentle person. Normally, of course, people like me are... Yeah. Necessarily, but and I would have thought that even with politicians there'd be that effect.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I don't know if you are aware, but Economist published a research a few years ago. There are now 100 million birders all over the world. 100 million. In the United States, for example, the first hobby was sport, the second was gardening, the third one, which for many years hunting and fishing, is now birding. So many people got really inspired of birds. You know, I think that almost every one of us sometime dream to fly when you are a kid. I was lucky to do it when I studied for the Israeli Air Force because, you know, we are a small country in a junction of 3 continents. From the political point of view, it's a disaster. We don't have to talk about it. But bird migration, because we are in a junction of 3 continents, this is like a bottleneck. It's a highway, and 500 million birds are flying over Israel twice a year. 1 billion birds on such a very small country. If you take the number of the birds and divide it to the size of the country, it's a world record.
How come?
because many of them avoid to cross the Mediterranean. You know, they are riding the thermals. So, for example, a white stork from Germany will move on a much longer way of about 800 kilometers, but on a way that they can save energy. So we are lucky to have this huge number of birds migrating over. And one of my missions is to try now to convince the decision makers and the public that Israel is not only history and archaeology, and bird migration is a big story which has also an economic value. And that's the reason we are now establishing a station on the Arkon River. And this is now a hotspot for people from Tel Aviv who are hiking, bicycling, running there. So we got from the government about 9 acres of land. And like we did in the Knesset with 60,000, I believe that now in Tel Aviv we'll have 120,000 people visiting the site every year. And as you said, I think that when they are coming and suddenly, even they are not bird lovers, suddenly they see a bird in hand and you have the chance to release them back to the wild freedom. Our slogan is, and I'm working also a lot with Palestinian and Jordanian, migrating birds know no boundaries. And that's a big story because the birds don't care about politics. I'm also attaching a radio transmitter to storks. Together with the Germans, we attached 120 storks with a radio. There is a French satellite, which is called Argos, which every 90 minutes you can get the location on the globe. We have 500 schools who are learning on migration through our website.
Yes.
So we have also now Palestinian students and Jordanian students. And this works. It gets the people together. One of the storks landed in Syria in the late evening. The other morning, the stork took off at 7:45. At 10, the stork was in Jordan. At 12, in the Palestinian Authority. At 1 o'clock in Israel. And the stork went to land in Egypt. So she passed 5 countries in one day.
Safely.
Safely. Sometimes people are shooting, but basically safely.
Amazing stuff. Now, what other typical birds are there that actually live in Israel?
In fact, we are privileged to have 540 different species which you can be seen in Israel. In Australia, you have 850, which is more. But if you divide the number of the species to the size of the country, Israel is much better because it's small. If you are a businessman, you want to see a lot of businessmen or others are running now to see many species, Israel is this place because it's very small, very condensed. You can see big numbers of birds. So we have big variety of desert birds, for example. You have also some of the birds that you can see only in Israel. You can't see them in Europe. So as I just came to Australia, this is my first visit in Australia, and I went to Barrie Island, and in one afternoon I saw 41 species. Out of the 41 species, 37 were new to me, lifers. So, you know, someone who likes it, for me, Australia is heaven already.
Twitching like crazy.
Exactly.
So you've got lots of special birds which come and go, and lots of special birds which are actually there. How do you yourself study them?
You know, when I told you that 1 billion birds are flying over Israel, because of the political situation, we have also a huge air force. If you take the number of the Israeli aircrafts, of the Israeli air force, divided to the size of the country, it's another world record. And the Israeli air force lost in 3 decades 9 aircraft. I'm talking now only 2 birds. 75 collisions of a damage of 1 million and more, and thousands of other collisions. So what I did, I was privileged to do my PhD with the Air Force. And what I did, you cannot chase 1 billion birds of a small country. So the idea was very simple, to study when are the birds coming and leaving, what height are they flying, what routes, and change the flight regulation and just separate. So what I did, I had a group of about 70 bird watchers who were scattered across the country and counting the birds. I was flying with a motorized glider for 272 days. Every day from a flock of pelicans, for example, who are coming from Lebanon, I flew with them till they came to the Egyptian border. In the spring migration, I waited them in the Egyptian border and I flew with them till the Lebanese border. So with the motorized glider, we were cutting the engine, and that's the way we found their routes. I used radars for the first time ever in the Middle East, and we studied the migration. Now the Israeli Air Force has a network of radars which gives them the ability to identify when are the big numbers, and then they stop to fly low. And I even use the drones, you know, the unmanned aircraft, which are for intelligence. This is a very expensive system, but because I did it for the Air Force, I got it free of charge, and we could study the birds first time ever in the world with drones.
That's cunning, yeah.
And the other issue that I was deeply involved with this satellite transmitter, you know, we gave them Jewish name, Muslim name, and Christian name to make it a global story. And one of these storks, which was called Princess from Germany, we followed the same stork for 13 years, leaving every year the nest in Germany, coming over Israel and moving to Cape Town. we made with the German TV a film with the ZDF, and we found out that this princess is going every year from a nest in Germany to a tree in Cape Town. She navigated from one tree to the other tree 11,000 kilometers, and she did it year after year. After 10 years, she came 2 weeks late to her husband because she was stuck with the bad weather in Sudan. When she came late to her husband after 10 years of very nice marriage, a new lady was sitting in the nest with four eggs, and she tried to chase it for 10 days, but too late.
Ah.
So if you're coming late to your husband, be careful. So she went 8 kilometers from the site, and she found a new male, and for 3 years she made it with a second husband. And we had a website, a big website, which is www.birds.org.il, and the students in the school could follow the bird online. So that was another issue, that we got the Palestinian and Jordanian students with the Israeli students, and they could join forces. And suddenly they see that they have the same ground. That's what we are also doing now with the farmers. And in fact, from here, I'm going traveling to Brazil, and there I will give a lecture to the entire conference, 1,400 ornithologists, with my Palestinian partner and the Jordanian general. In fact, it's a general who retired from the army and decided to join forces under the title Birds as Peacemaker in Conflict Areas.
Ah, birds as peacemaker. That's very interesting. Because while you were talking, it struck me that one solution to the problem with the Air Force colliding with birds is to get rid of the Air Force.
No, we didn't get rid of the Air Force. The idea is just to change the maneuvers in the training zones. And we split them. They were flying above the birds on the migration time. And we were really privileged to reduce the number of collisions by 76%, saving them $800 million. And of course, the most important part is the life of the pilot. A few years ago, I gave a presentation to the Royal Air Force in Britain. And after I finished the lecture, a lady, a wife of one of the generals, stood up and said, Dr. Leshem, you are telling us about the pilots, but don't forget that you are also saving the life of the birds. This is typically British. But she's right. That's also. But, you know, people are, of course, part of it.
Very, very important. Okay, so you're traveling the world. How many people whom you talk to about this particular theme, how many take you seriously on that and act upon it?
I have to tell you, my parents came to Israel from Germany. My mother was a nature lover. She liked to hike, but she couldn't distinguish a donkey of a bird. But then, and I think she was privileged to get me in love with nature. After I finished my army service, I decided that I wanted my hobby will be my job. And I decided to be an ornithologist because I fall in love with birds. And then she panicked because she is a Jewish mother. She wanted me to be a lawyer or a physician. She said, how can you make a living of studying birds? So when I'm giving sometime lecture to youngsters, I always tell them, don't listen to your parents. If you have a passion to something, go on it. And I'm sure you will succeed. So I'm really happy with what I'm doing. I think that many people, they think, as I give here to different Jewish community and other people, they say, no, he couldn't find a better job than he is an ornithologist.
Oh, no, I'm sure your job is wonderful.
No, I'm sure.
If you think of the dove of peace, but yeah, there's also the raptor, the eagle, which is very aggressive. So ornithology could be really the way forward to world peace. And I mean that seriously, because in many ways, if you think of one of the stories I've told before on the Science Show is of the duck pond in the hospital. They were designing a hospital and they thought, well, here we've got the old folks' ward. They're all dying of cancer. And we have to put the children somewhere close by. And that's going to be a bit difficult.
True.
They put a duck pond in the middle. And of course, the kids wanted to feed the ducks.
Sure.
The ducks were very friendly. And the old folk came out to help the kids feed the ducks. And so here you had something which united,
I tell you,
two pair.
I have no doubt. I am now, as I said, for four decades in this. Nature get people relaxed. You know, the Israelis, for example, it's a small country, a very tense country, always with the conflicts. But when people go out and they suddenly see, for example, we have now in the north, in the Hula Valley, it's a big wetland, 35,000 cranes are wintering there. And the people get really inspired when they see 35,000 cranes. We are feeding them to reduce the pressure on agriculture field. And we have even a carriage with a tractor, which you can go between the cranes. They are very tame. And I can see how people that are not interested in birds at all, suddenly something moves in their heart. Say, wow, this is something different. And at any something more. You know, when I was younger, I was leading a bird club in Jerusalem with Teddy Kolek, at that time the mayor. He gave me the funds. And I had about 200 birders. And very strange, I found out that 90% of my birders are males, not females, which doesn't look logic. No, no. The birds are, they are colorful, they are flying, they are singing. It's like a dance. And I couldn't understand why not enough females, girls, are coming to the club. Then someone published a scientific paper that the birders, they are like hunters. The gene of hunting is with males. So in the past, they were shooting the birds and killing them. Now you are shooting them with a camera telescope or binocular. So most of these males, they are like hunters. And in fact, out of these 100 million birders, many of them, they are called in Britain twitchers. They are going for lifeless. They want to show them, you know, they want to go in the evening to the
same
pub.
Same here.
Yeah, I know, I'm sure. And they were in the pub, these tenses fell. I went to Israel, you have seen 220 species. I beat you, I saw 241. I saw even the rare eagle. And then his friend get depressed and he is happy. This is part of the game.
Dr. Yossi Leshem is the director of the International Center for the Study of Bird Migration at Tel Aviv University in Israel. Well, last week, sadly, we heard the last of David Attenborough's marvellous talks on natural history. And so to make up for that, this time, the new Aussie David Attenborough, someone who studies gelada baboons and is working on David's final TV series. Chad and Hunter is with Lynn Malcolm.
You know, like so many young biologists, David Attenborough's career was an inspiration. I was 7 years of age when his first series, Life on Earth, came out. And I remember getting so excited by it. My mother would tell stories of me climbing up the back of the sofa with my back pressed against the lounge room wall because I was so tense with excitement, whispering to her that that's what I wanted to do. So it was a real pinch-yourself moment when, at the age of 28, there I was at my field site, having studied the gelada for years, and David Attenborough arriving. So the first time I met the great man was at my field site. And to be standing there telling him about the gelada, this was for a series called Life of Mammals. And David has a real keen interest in hearing from scientists and researchers. I think he trusts them a little more than TV producers. So he really wanted to hear all about them. And he's such a curious guy that it really was a defining moment, I guess, of my career to be there at 28 telling your childhood hero what to say in a script and what not to say in a script because you knew about these monkeys.
Wildlife biologist Chadden Hunter was born in Mount Isa in Queensland. He specialised in bowerbirds at the University of Queensland in Cairns, but his taste for exotica soon took him to the upper highlands of Ethiopia, where he lived for 3 years with gelada baboons.
It's the only monkey in the world that lives on grass. It's about the size of a baboon, so quite broad shoulders, but has these beautiful silky coats of chocolate and golden, so these big manes. It looks a bit like a cross between Lassie and a werewolf. And they have wonderful big canines and a bare pink chest patch, which is the equivalent of their sexual window, like other baboons have a swollen pink backside when they're showing their sexual state. But the gelada, being the world's only grass-eating monkey, they have to sit down the entire day to pluck grass, and so their sexual state has changed to their chest. That was one element of it. I was looking at the whole social system there, which is one of the richest social systems of any non-human primate. They're broken down into family groups of about 4 or 5 females and 1 male. But the family groups come together into clans and then tribes, and they can sometimes form groups as big as 800. So I was really looking at this incredibly hierarchical social structure and what ecological factors affected it, whether it was the distribution of the grass they were eating, whether it was the breeding season, bringing females into fertility more and males getting more excited about getting into family groups.
You describe your first encounter as something like wandering into a riot of werewolves. That must have been frightening.
Yeah, I mean, they're such charismatic animals, and it's such a striking scene because you're in the Ethiopian highlands at 3,000 to 4,000 metres, so you're almost twice the height of Kosciuszko. This is really, really up there, and you're way above the tree line, but up on these beautiful alpine plateaus, which are just grass, you walk across 800 screaming and carrying on baboons who are all chasing and wrestling and grooming. And it's such a strange sight. You expect to see Julie Andrews singing Sound of Music up there, and you've got these shaggy, golden and chocolate-maned baboons covering the landscape.
Mm. And as part of this study, you spent 3 years living with the gelada baboon in a mud hut in the Ethiopian highlands.
What was that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, I was young at the time. I started it when I was 24, and it's not a lifestyle you'd catch me doing now. But it was a childhood dream of mine always to do that Dian Fossey thing, the, you know, gorillas in the mist, living with wildlife. And so I was really living a childhood dream at the time. It was very, very remote. I mean, the mud hut was at about 3,500 meters, and my fresh water supply was just some slimy green pools in the rock. And I lived by candlelight for 3 years. That was the only light I had. So it was a very, very rough existence. I wore local robes that the Ethiopians wear and just ate rice. But I think that privilege of being out there with one of the most incredible animals in this beautiful, beautiful setting of these jagged and rugged mountains really was the dream of a lifetime for a wildlife biologist.
And it was quite life-threatening at times, wasn't it? You actually became victim to some brain parasites, I believe.
That's right. I mean, I had about every parasite under the sun up there, Shigella, typhoid, Giardia, amoeba, you name it. But the one that really took the prize was it's called schistosomiasis, and it's a microscopic blood worm that burrows into your skin in swampy waters and then navigates through your bloodstream trying to find the liver or the kidneys. And it's usually quite benign. It causes the disease Bilharzia, which people might have heard of. But people can live with it often for years. The only thing is, because it's in your blood, it can get lost. And my little couple of worms, the male and female, got lost in my bloodstream and ended up in my brain, where they set up their white picket fence and started to raise a family. And so basically when they were laying eggs in the capillaries in my brain, it would stop the blood flow, stop the oxygen, and it would cause a full epileptic seizure. Now, I didn't know this was happening, because when you wake up from a fit, you just feel a bit groggy. Mm. And the Ethiopian locals were seeing me do it, but they weren't saying anything because they thought I was exercising monkey demons. So it was only very luckily that the BBC film crew were there and actually watched me have one of these epileptic fits caused by the parasitic eggs in my brain. And that was the only reason that somebody alerted me to it, and I was able to get out of there and get treated.
So while you were there, how well did you get to know the baboons and befriend them?
Obviously, when you're up there and for so long, they really do become your family in a sense. And as a scientist, of course, you try not to interact, and your job is really just to observe. That got harder and harder as the baboons got to know you, because you do become a bit one of the troop, really. And you have to avoid making direct eye contact, because that's always seen as a threat in gelada society. That's the way they face off against rivals. And so a lot of my research was done just out of the corner of my eye. I wouldn't try and look at them, and I wouldn't try and take sides in fights. But you got to know certain individuals so well, and their personalities are so different. You've got the aggressive monkeys and the passive ones and the deceitful ones, and you've got just such a rich cast of characters there that it's hard to not start naming them and not start having your favorites. One male in particular named Chewbacca was a handsome, big, hairy guy, and I got to kind of watch his whole life trajectory up through his younger years and his rise to power. So he was always a favorite of mine, and I've kind of kept track of him ever since.
And did you learn anything from these baboons and their social behaviour, which you've been able to incorporate into your own life?
Well, funny, I mean, I sometimes think that animals are a lot more civilized than humans every now and then, but it's certainly fascinating watching the way they deal with conflict resolution, because, of course, they have a lot of conflict and social problems in their own lives and their own families, just like we do. And it is remarkable how quickly they learn to forgive and make up. And they use grooming. That's what cements their society together, in a bit the same way that we use gossip or social chit-chat. So it's quite fascinating watching them resolve a conflict in the way that pairs of monkeys would, say, start grooming each other as a bit of an apology. And it's something that's carried through in our primate genes to this day. I mean, if you go to the hairdresser and you're getting your hair done, the human body starts coursing endorphins through the blood. And that really is a kickback to our early primate roots and how important grooming is to bond individuals.
During the time Chad and Hunter spent living with the gelada baboons in the late 90s, Ethiopia declared war on Eritrea to the north.
Yeah, it was a very sad time, the Ethiopian-Eritrean War. It was the largest war in the world for 2 years, but it got very, very little coverage. And it was a trench war fought like something out of World War I, just about 100 kilometres north of my field site. So those horrific stories of just teenagers being forced to walk in front of trenches, in front of machine guns, and just getting mowed down. I think the conservative estimates are that over 100,000 people died in trench warfare. And what the Ethiopian government was doing was, I guess, they would take policemen to go and fight. They would take farmers to go and fight. They were recruiting from every part of the country. And it kind of created a bit of a security vacuum in the mountains where I was working. A lot of the upstanding young men of the society had gone off with their rifles to the war. So what you started to get was more of the bandits coming out of the woodwork and coming out of the caves and the gullies. So it created a bit of a lawlessness in the hinterland anyway. But it was just sad that so many young Ethiopians were being dragged off to a trench warfare that they knew nothing about.
That must have been so disturbing, though, being there and witnessing that. Did it just make you feel like you needed to get out of there?
Yeah, it was a very, very hard time. There was one stage where I think I was the only foreigner in the entire north of Ethiopia, which is something like this, you know, the size of France. Everybody else had been evacuated by their foreign embassies. At one stage, I thought, well, the safest place for me is to stay right out here in these remote mountains with the baboons. And trying to get back on the roads, which were controlled by the military, just seemed a little hairier than staying up there. And each day I'd be hanging out with the baboons and we would see the fighter jets go overhead, passing over us with bombs on their wings, to the trench warfare that we could just see on the horizon. We could see the fires from the trenches at nighttime. And then at the end of the day, you'd see these jet fighters come back over you and the baboons with all the bombs not on the wings anymore. And you know that they'd been, you know, dropped on a hell of a lot of soldiers.
Did you sense that the baboons knew that something was amiss?
I mean, they certainly react to gunfire. We had a few shootouts around our camp every now and then. But the gelada are fairly robust animals. Baboons in general are quite adaptable. So they weren't that shy of humans. They're quite wary and quite intelligent, know when to get out of the way. But I think just because they have such big brains, they're not that easily spooked.
And you shared what you were finding out about the gelada baboons with the local Ethiopians. What was their response?
It was funny at first because the Ethiopians have a lot of conflict with the gelada because the gelada raid their barley crops. So they're not really fans of the monkeys. They consider them vermin. So they thought it was absolutely ridiculous that a foreigner would come from so far away and risk their health and risk their sanity just to study this animal that they considered vermin. And they thought that gelada must be a pest all over the world. For them, gelada are like rats. So it was quite interesting being able to share with them the reasons why I'd come so far to see gelada. Basically, gelada are endemic to Ethiopia. They're found nowhere else. And this was something that seemed like news to a lot of Ethiopians. They just couldn't believe that we didn't have them as pests in Australia. So it was interesting over the years to share that appreciation for an animal that was unique to Ethiopia and was something that they could really be proud of.
David Attenborough and the BBC film crew paid a visit to Chadden Hunter and the gelada baboons in Ethiopia for the series One Planet. And this was the beginning of Chadden's filmmaking career with David Attenborough. Next week, we'll hear from him about his work with Attenborough on the upcoming BBC series Frozen Planet.
And that's an equally astounding story from a remarkable young man, Lynn Malcolm with Chadden Hunter. And at least he didn't have volcanoes to cope with amongst all that, unlike Matthew Crawford. But the ones in New Zealand are, in the main, not too violent. Matthew.
Mount Eden, or Mangafo in the local Maori language. It's a green and pleasant hill, 196 metres tall, located pretty much in the middle of Auckland City. It's an urban oasis with dog walkers, joggers and tourist coaches bringing people up to admire the beautiful views. From here I can spot, well, rather a few other green and pleasant hills, and that's part of Auckland's geological history. These are basalt volcanoes, 50 or so. Auckland is a city of 1.3 million people, located pretty much in the middle of a volcanic field. And not even an extinct one. This field is merely dormant. And looking out across the harbour, I can see Rangitoto Island, the site of Auckland's most recent and largest volcanic eruption, merely hundreds of years ago. Well, I'm down from Mount Eden now and in the inner city, Albert Park, which is beside the site of one of Auckland's first eruptions, many tens of thousands of years before Rangitoto. The small scoria cone that rose has since been quarried away, but this is a good place to meet Ian Smith, the head of the geology program at the University of Auckland. Ian was recently elected a fellow of the Geological Society of Australia. He studies the magma that erupts from volcanoes to help us understand how they behave and the hazards they present. And Ian, what is a basalt volcano and how is Auckland's field, for instance, related to that rather spectacular eruption in Iceland?
Quite different is one answer. The similarity is that both the Icelandic volcano that I'm not going to try and pronounce and Auckland, they're both basalt. Now, the significance of that is that you get basalt magma when the mantle melts. So somewhere like 80 kilometres beneath our feet, possibly even at the moment, the mantle is melting. It's quite fluid. It's quite hot, rises very quickly up to the surface. And that's where we can say that there's the similarities. The difference is beneath Iceland is the mid-Atlantic Rift. It's the midpoint of the oceans where the two plates are spreading apart. And at relatively shallow depths, probably shallower than the 80 kilometres I just mentioned, the mantle is melting, and it's melting in quite a voluminous way. So really it's making new oceanic crust on the island of Iceland. Auckland, the degree of melting is much smaller, and what seems to be happening is you get a little bit of melt and the melt rises, a bit like those lava lamps you see. You know, the old-fashioned yes. lava lamps where you get a rise of a blob of stuff? It's a bit like that.
How is it related to other types of volcanoes?
The simplest way to talk about that is talk about three kinds of volcanoes. There's basalt, and there's a range of different sorts of basalt volcano. There's andesite volcanoes, and these are the classic volcanoes like Mount St. Helens or Mount Etna, Mount Vesuvius, and so on. And those are volcanoes that are located on plate boundaries. Most of the world's historic eruptions, the big disasters, have been from andesite volcanoes. And then there are rhyolite volcanoes, and these are often referred to as supervolcanoes because they're bigger, so we actually have a hierarchy from small basalt volcanoes to intermediate-sized andesite volcanoes to really big eruptions of essentially not so much cones but holes in the ground, and Yellowstone would be a good example of that. So there are these three kinds, basalts, andesites and rhyolites.
Well, what about that field of basalt volcanoes in Victoria that stretches into South Australia?
Well, that's much bigger.
What kind of relationship does that have to the Auckland field?
Same sort of tectonic setting, by which I mean that they are not on a plate boundary. Now, most of the world's active volcanoes lie on a plate boundary, either a divergent plate boundary like Iceland or a convergent plate boundary like Central North Island.
And what, they tend to give you the more spectacular ones, do they?
Yeah, they give you the more explosive ones. No, there's something going on, obviously a disturbance in the mantle, which is creating melts, and some kind of tectonic situation which allows the melts to rise. And these things are scattered around the world.
Well, is it a case of when or if, when we look at Auckland, in terms of another volcanic eruption?
I would say when. That answer to the question is taken sufficiently seriously that there's a lot of money and effort going into planning for the next eruption in Auckland. Having said that, then the next question is, oh, well, when's it going to be? And I don't know that. It won't be today, because we've got quite a good warning system in Auckland, and it's going to tell us at least days, probably weeks beforehand. But it could be at any time.
How are you going to break that news if you start to get suspicious readings on your...
Oh, again, there's a system. We're looking for tremors, for little earthquakes that occur as the magmas rise. Someone will be alerted if there's more than probably two or three earthquakes underneath Auckland, and then the planning has allowed for scenarios to develop from that. You know, we're not looking at the whole city being destroyed. We're looking at parts of the city being affected. And so the mitigation then is to educate people of what might happen, warn people when we think it might be going to happen, and organise, you know, evacuations and that sort of thing. I mean, if there was an eruption in the middle of Auckland, you can imagine even quite small eruptive effects would be economically devastating. I mean, when Ruapehu erupted in 1995 and 1996...
That's in the Central North Island.
So it's over 300 kilometres from here. There was a big economic impact because they had to close the airport. And you couldn't even see ash, but there was sufficient atmospheric effect that they closed the airport.
And what about these fields of basalt volcanoes? Will they have that same ash effect?
No, the volumes are much smaller. Well, having said that, Ruapehu in 95 and 96 was a very small eruption. You know, we measure volumes in terms of cubic kilometres of magma, and that was about a tenth of a cubic kilometre. Compare that with Mount St. Helens in 1980, which was, I think, between 1 and 5 cubic kilometres. And bigger eruptions of 10 cubic kilometres have occurred in the last 100 years. Well, in Auckland, the total volume, 50 volcanoes, the total volume of magma is about 4 cubic kilometres.
And that's spread over, what, 100,000 years or something?
Rangitoto was 2 cubic kilometres. So we've got the remaining 2 cubic kilometres spread over 49 volcanoes and 200,000 plus years. I do not expect a widespread dispersal of ash. For a start, the ash won't go very high and it won't go very far. But that Icelandic eruption was bigger than an Auckland one. Also, because it was under a glacier, there was a lot of water involved. And when you get water involved, you get more explosive eruptions, you get higher eruption, you know, kilometres high, and then dispersal by the wind. So all the factors were there for the Icelandic volcano to affect Europe. If we look around Auckland, apart from when you're actually on the volcanoes, there's very little ash. I mean, I live, 3 kilometres from here, not far from Rangitoto, 5 kilometres from Rangitoto. There's no ash in my garden, unfortunately.
Be good for the growing, would it?
No, good drainage.
Tell me about the project Devora, Determining Volcanic Risk in Auckland.
It's a 7-year study. 4 years of the 7-year project are looking at the science, looking at why we have magmas, what happens when they come to the surface. Other 3 years, applying that science to society and trying to quantify the risk and trying to define what the problems will be, and that's where the dollars hopefully will be well spent. This, I think, will make Auckland one of the, if not the best, studied small volcanic field in the world.
Dr. Ian Smith with Matthew Crawford in Auckland, New Zealand. Well, next week, something completely different, apart from the remarkable Dr. Chadden Hunter. Matt Ridley on being a rational optimist. Dr. Ridley has written many famous science books like The Red Queen, Nature via Nurture, and also recently a biography of Francis Crick. Now it's optimism.
Well, I've been amazed by the wrongness of pessimists for a very long time, so I was taking a longer view than that. I was reacting partly to what people said in the 70s to me about how the world had no bright future, only a bleak one, and how again and again and again pessimistic predictions had proved to be wrong. But I was writing in the middle of an unprecedented financial crisis that seemed at one point could bring world trade to a juddering halt and plunge the whole world into a deep depression. But I looked back. One of the first things I did was look back at the similar events in the 1720s, the South Sea Bubble, in the 1930s, the Great Depression. And I noticed that although some countries suffered terribly during these times, the world as a whole just kept marching on. Technology kept reinventing itself. Living standards kept rising. Even in America, the worst hit country in the 1930s, GDP per capita was back up to 1929 levels by 1938. So I was pretty convinced, utterly against the conventional wisdom of the time, in 2008, that yes, this was going to be a horrible recession, but no, it was not going to derail the progress of the world economy. And sure enough, we sit here now, and in 2010, India is growing at 9% and China at 10% and the world as a whole at 4.5%.
Matt Ridley next week, and on Catalyst on ABC Television, a special on fatherhood by Dr. Jonica Newby, part 2, the follow-up to the male pregnancy. Can science show us what makes a better father? Catalyst on ABC One, 8 p.m. next Thursday. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Charlie McCune. I'm Robin Williams.